Good afternoon, and I'll call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorff to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson?
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon?
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll?
O'Driscoll, present.
Representative Barr?
Here.
Representative Carlson?
Carlson is present.
Representative Dabney? Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins?
Elkins present.
Representative Haley?
Haley present.
Representative Cagle?
Present.
Representative Lee?
Lee present.
Representative Lilly? Representative Lilly? Representative Listlegard?
Listlegard present.
Representative Lucero?
Lucero. Present.
Representative Olson?
Present.
Representative Farr?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Richardson?
Present.
Representative Tice?
Tice, present.
Representative Dabney? And Representative Lilly, are you here?
Lilly, present.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
A quorum is present. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from February 8th of 2022. Representative Cotiza Watoon, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move approval of the February 8th minutes.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon moves approval of our minutes from February 8th, 2022. Any discussion to that motion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 8th, 2022 are approved. We're doing something a little different today. We are gonna take a look back at a couple of provisions that passed into law as part of the Omnibus Commerce, Climate and Energy Finance Bill that passed into law last spring and summer. These are a couple of very significant provisions out of a bill that I was very happy with that had a lot of great and forward-thinking new laws in it, but these two are particularly consequential to Minnesotans as they relate to the cost of health insurance and also to our student loan crisis. So first, we're going to be taking a look at the the health mandate review process that was, as I mentioned, passed into law last summer and implemented in the fall. We're going to have the Department of Commerce explain what kind of work they've been up to on that. And then we're going to look at that in action with regard to three proposals that were submitted for review by three different members. So first, we'll have this presentation from the Department of Commerce, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Brickwitty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. Good to be with you again, members. I'm going to, in hand, turn it over to my colleague, Galen Benchouf, who is the department's Director of Regulation and Policy Strategy in the Insurance Division, to talk about the process and lessons learned overall, and then we'll get into the individual findings from the department as we move through those bills. So,
thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Mr. Benchouf.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the process behind year one implementation of the 62J benefit mandate evaluation reports and what we're planning for the coming year. So last summer, to start off with, after we received notification of the requested bills, Commerce began initial research, including literature reviews, and we continued to build out our project plan at that time. 62J directs Commerce to publish preliminary information on each requested bill prior to that final publication of the reports. So for that preliminary information, we created what we called preliminary analyses on each requested bill, including bill descriptions, associated health conditions, associated diagnostic procedure, service and product codes, and initial research resources identified. And we included all of those preliminary analyses in a request for information, and we published that RFI on our website on November 19th, 2021. We also included a notice in the State Register on November 22nd that the RFI was available on our website, and we asked for public feedback on elements of those analyses within 30 days of the publication in the State Register. We sought public comment on any element of the requested bill that stakeholders wish to provide info on, but we also identified a few questions that Commerce had particular interest in, such as what effect the bill would have on how patients access care, what the cost impact would be, if any, and what additional resources Commerce should consult. We also consulted with MMB and MDH at this stage, as directed by the statute. We also sent them specific questions related to their own available data. In particular, from MDH, we were interested in APCD data, and from MMB, we sought fiscal estimates from CGIP, as well as any relevant high-level claims information available. So after that, we began drafting the evaluation reports and then incorporated comments received from the public as they came in as appropriate. So that's just a brief overview of year one. Looking ahead to year two, I'd say for the most part, we felt like the first year went well, but we have a few things we think we can sharpen for the second year. We are again planning to issue an RFI containing similar preliminary analyses of requested bills. Next year, we'd like to see if we can get the word out a bit more broadly about the RFI and the associated timeline, including better leveraging the bill authors to spread awareness about that comment period. In the RFI, we may pose potentially more detailed questions that are specific to the various bills rather than the higher level prompts that we included first time around. In the first year, we were able to complete all of the evaluation reports with existing staff time. But I'd say we were definitely stretched considering all the other initiatives happening concurrently in our insurance division in the fall and winter. And for that reason, we may put some or most of the work out for bid in the second year and beyond. Hiring a contractor means we'd be able to go more deeply into some aspects of the evaluation than we were able to do with staff time alone. So that's our plan for the coming year, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
So if members have questions for Mr. Benshoof about the overall process that Commerce undertook in evaluating the proposals that were submitted, now would be a good time to ask. If you have questions about specific bills, I'd ask that you hold those until we get to the specific bills. Before I turn it over for those questions, I do just want to kind of remind members and alert the public as to what happened sort of behind the scenes on the legislative side. The bill required people who were wanting to advance proposals to have new insurance mandates to submit those to either the chair of the Commerce Committee or the chair of the Health Committee by, I believe, August 1st, although maybe it was August 31st. Now I'm having a brain, I need to jog my memory. But in any event, a couple of weeks before that, I sent an email out to all members of the House reminding of them of that deadline and asking them to make any requests to me or Chair Liebling before the deadline. I believe we received 8 such requests from members. We passed all 8 along to the Department of Commerce when they completed evaluation of all 8. So after we get through questions, I have chosen 3 of the 8 to highlight for the members of the committee and for the public so that you can kind of see the type of work that Commerce was doing. Each of the bills, they reached a somewhat different conclusion or had a somewhat different analysis. So I think this will give you a kind of good taste of the various outcomes that can come from these types of analysis. So that's my brief summary. And now Representative Elkins has a question. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, in terms of the process, the only comment I would like to make is that, the department did put out a request for information through kind of normal channels, which means that anybody with a service that monitors requests for information, bill monitoring systems got it. And so when if you look at the comments in response to House File 56, which we're going to talk about substantively later, all of the comments were from industry. And I don't recall, I apologize if I received something and overlooked it, but I would have appreciated as the author of that particular proposal being notified that the RFI period was being opened so that I could have notified the bill's advocates so that they could have submitted comments to the record as well. I'm sure they would have done. So just for next go around, reaching out to the bill's authors, soliciting their help and soliciting additional feedback from other stakeholders would be appreciated.
Thanks, Representative Elkins. I think that's a very good suggestion. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Representative Elkins, I was going to raise the same point, and I think that's very well taken. I think we will definitely want to look not only how we sort of use our partnerships with you and other bill authors to sort of shout this as widely as possible, but other mechanisms beyond just the state register for publicizing it as well. I'd add two additional points. Mr. Chairman, you did have it right the first time. August 1st was the deadline, and a thank you to you and your staff, both past and present, for helping us get those requests in and organized so that we could get the clock moving on them. And a number of members who were authors of the proposals, we actually talked to them in real time in early August or a little bit afterwards, just to make sure we had the right language. And we were looking at what you wanted us to be looking at. So I know that was a question that came up in a couple of places. So those important early clarifications made sure we were on the right track. And I would add just one other thing to Mr. Benchuk's comments too, that I think it's going to be very helpful for us to understand how you and members in the other bodies, policymakers, are going to use these reports this year so that we, if there are additional sort of tailoring or different sets of kinds of questions that we can then ask in subsequent reports to make sure that they're useful tools for you all as you receive the analysis. That's something that I think will be an important lesson learned for us as we move through this session as well and we go into the next cycle.
Thank you, Mr. Rickaway. And I would second what you just said at the end there and ask committee members to, you know, as we're looking at the three bills today, you know, we're not taking formal action on these three bills, in part because two of them are in the health committee already. We moved them out of this committee last year. I hope that members ask the questions that they would normally ask and kind of drill down as if we were going to vote on it, because it will help Commerce understand how we use the information in future years so they can be more responsive when the committee is considering bills that will be voted upon. With that, seeing no further sort of general questions, let's move through the bills in question. The first bill that we're going to take a look at is House File 633, offered by Representative Bierman. As I just mentioned, this is one of the bills that is actually in the possession of the Health Committee. Our committee took this bill up last year and passed it out of committee onto Health. So this is purely informational. But Representative Bierman, if you would like to describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair, members of the committee. It was almost exactly 1 year ago, and I was before you to speak about House File 633. And now we have the Department of Commerce report. So report of the department says that this bill will improve public health and reduce financial barriers to healthcare, with most insurers noting no significant impact on premiums. So I hope that the department's analysis, which puts potential concerns about the cost impacts to rest, will increase your support for the bill. 11 states have adopted some form of drug benefit restructuring to make drug costs more manageable for patients. The most recent example is Illinois, which passed a law last summer that's very similar to what we're seeking here. House File 633 comes down somewhere in the middle of all of these proposals, which I think speaks well of our effort to strike a sensible balance with our bill. This bill will help individuals facing high prescription drug costs in all our communities. Minnesotans suffering from chronic and serious illness should not have to choose between their medications and other basic needs. When high deductibles and coinsurance get in the way of patients taking the drugs they need, we see deteriorating health and higher mortality. House File 633 would provide relief to people on the individual and small group markets who face costly monthly prescriptions. This bill would require plans in these markets to offer products that use only copays on all prescription drug benefits, with the highest copay at 1/12 of the annual maximum out of pocket. These copays are pre-deductible, so the plan member doesn't have to write a check of several thousand dollars before coverage begins. This benefit is like offering a local utility, offering you to spread out your natural gas expenses over the full year, but without the heavy burden of thousands of dollars in upfront deductible and co-insurance costs in January and February. The bill would add a new subdivision 6 to the Minnesota statutes, which set our essential health benefit package requirements for health insurance. Lines 1.8 to 1.17 of my bill refer to the individual and small group markets, respectively. Each segment requires that health insurers who do business in these markets must make sure that at least 25% of the plans they sell include a copay-only prescription drug benefit. The 25% requirement is consistent for all coverage levels, bronze, silver, and gold. I expect we will be bringing a small number of technical amendments forward as this bill moves again this session, none of which should impact the Commerce Department's favorable findings toward our bill. So, members, in summary, insurance should serve the needs of people rather than people serving the needs of insurance. This bill is not a mandate for a benefit that people must purchase. It has no fiscal cost, but it will make a big difference for thousands of Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, I would appreciate if the committee could now also hear from Mr. Dana Bacon of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society for some more pertinent comments to the bill regarding HF 633, please.
Absolutely, Representative Bierman. Mr. Bacon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Representative Bierman said, I'm Dana Bacon, and I'm the Minnesota Government Affairs Director for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'd like to thank you for having me here to talk about the report, and I'd like to thank the Commerce Department staff for preparing this report and taking the time to help us get to the bottom of things. I'm here on behalf of my own organization, but I'm also the organizer of a coalition of 23 patient, physician, pharmacy, rural, and public health groups that have endorsed House File 633 and its Senate companion, Senate File 365, authored by Senator Carla Nelson. Let's imagine two patients on the same medication that costs $5,000 per month. They both have health plans with $3,000 deductibles and annual out-of-pocket caps of $8,400. One patient pays co-insurance of 40% per month on that drug. The other has a copay-only plan, like the kind asked for in House File 633. In January, the coinsurance patient will pay $3,800. In February, and again in March, the coinsurance patient will pay $2,000. In April, the coinsurance patient pays $600 and hits their annual cap of $8,400. For the copay-only patient, their payments for that same drug are $700 each month. They will hit their annual cap in December, assuming no other expenses that contribute toward that cap, but they will pay the same $8,400 a year the coinsurance patient pays. $700 a month is nothing insignificant, but it is much more manageable than paying nearly $8,000 in the first 3 months of the year. That is the practical value of copay-only benefits that inspired us to work with Representative Bierman on this bill. And who are the patients? The full list of supporters for House File 633 gives us some idea of how broadly valued this legislation is. It includes advocacy groups concerned about cancer, arthritis, HIV and AIDS, mental illness, multiple sclerosis, psoriasis, hemophilia, rare diseases, and autoimmune conditions. Support also includes state medical, pharmacy, oncology, and rural health associations. I'm honored to be working with each and every one of these groups to bring this bill forward and to put the Commerce Department's results to use. Of course, when Commerce reviewed this bill, it didn't have to account only for the patient benefit, which we've established as significant. It must also account for the bill's impact on the health insurance market. You can already look for yourselves at the citations contained in the report. The Commerce Department said the bill does not place a mandate, and every insurer but one who commented said the bill would have no significant impact on premiums. I'm glad they said that, because it lines up well with the data we've been bringing forward the entire time. In Colorado, they used the kind of copay reform we're asking for with House File 633. This week, I looked at bronze, silver, and gold plans on the 2022 individual market in Fort Collins, Colorado, to ask myself what the premium difference was between the cheapest copay reform and non-copay products in the state. We all know that people should shop on more than just premiums, but it's often where consumers start when they ask themselves what to buy, and it's probably no small contributing factor to how Minnesota's individual market plays out, with the largest proportion of plans being sold being bronze products. So back to Colorado. Six companies sell marketplace plans in Fort Collins in 2022. The gap in premiums between the cheapest copay-only product and non-copay bronze product was 2.3%. For silver plans, that gap was 0.9%. For gold plans, that gap was 2.6%. What we're seeing here is good news. It confirms what we heard in the Commerce Report. It shows that plans are competing on premiums and providing flexible options for consumers at the bronze, silver, and gold levels. Also important, the only people paying these modest premium increases are the people who value and need the predictability of copay-only products. So, thank you for listening to me today. If you remember one thing from my remarks, I'd ask you to remember this. A lot of respected groups support this bipartisan bill because it will help patients. And now you have the credible, objective evidence you sought to show that this bill will work without disrupting health coverage for others in Minnesota. I would ask that when you and others in the legislature think about how to use the reports, and especially when the findings are like this, I would say this is the year to move from asking for the evidence to acting upon the evidence. We know this bill will help. We know it works responsibly. And we need lawmakers to put the results of this process to work for patients. Thanks for your time, and I hope you'll help us get this bill across the finish line this year.
Thank you, Mr. Bacon. We will now hear from the Department of Commerce as to their report. Is this Mr. Benshoof who's going to speak to this, or Mr. Brickwee? Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to hit on a few high-level points, and of course, would be happy to stand for any additional questions. So, on the Affordable Care Act benefit mandate analysis, that was a big piece of what we looked at for each of these bills, and for this one, we concluded that it was not a benefit mandate under the ACA requiring state defrayal of costs because it did not add any new benefits. Prescription drugs are already required to be included. The bill merely requires modifications and cost sharing of existing benefits, and Commerce has come to the same conclusion in the past for bills that do similar things. So it does not require state defrayal of costs in that sense, and it does not apply to CGIP or other public programs, so Commerce does not anticipate any fiscal impact to the state overall. And finally, we would expect any premium increase to be low, and it would be specific to the copay-only plans themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Benshoof. Now I'll open it up for member questions or discussion as to the bill or the report by the Department of Commerce. Any questions or discussion? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also just want to say thank you. I really appreciate the work that was put together to get us this information as we evaluate these different proposals. Definitely more information than we've had previously as we've discussed this. And so I very appreciate that. Also, I'm glad to hear that Commerce is building on this work for next session. The question I had is on the cost piece and on the analysis that was done on the impact that this will have on health insurance premiums. You know, for this bill, you know, the information said, you know, that basically, you know, difficult to quantify, you know, unlikely to produce a substantive increase in premiums. And I guess my first question, Mr. Chair, is for Commerce in terms of, you know, why they didn't try to put more specific numbers on that or a range of what the cost could be. And they also note that they received a range of estimates from the health plans and their actuaries. So just wanted to get some color as to, you know, why they didn't put numbers onto their analysis and what a substantive increase means.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Mr. Benchoof.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks for the question on this. I would say that, well, first of all, as to the responses from the health plans, we didn't receive specific per member per month estimates from all of them. And so, you know, didn't feel super confident even in a range. But I would say that there are a number of factors that would influence the ultimate premium impact, if there is any, the utilization of certain drugs and whether they change and in which direction and what cost they are would all come to bear on that ultimate number. I think the idea behind the bill is to lower barriers to prescription drug adherence. And so presumably utilization would increase to some degree, but again, it's going to depend on really the underlying costs of the drugs that are increasing significantly in utilization. And so just pulling from what actuaries found in other states as well, Colorado and Montana did not appear to experience any kind of premium increase as a result of similar initiatives that they adopted in their states. And so that certainly influenced our conclusion that any increases that we would expect to see would be minimal.
Mr. Chairman, I would add on to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rasmussen, I think the actuarial study on the impact in the state of Colorado is in the footnote on at the top of page 11 of our analysis on this report. And I think I would echo Mr. Benchoof's comments about it being difficult to sort of construct a range without specific per member per month comments. But I think that in this particular case, we'll talk about how this one differs from some subsequent bills here in a moment, but that there's pretty solid experience from other states that also, I think, helps us understand what the potential impact would be. Obviously, those other states have different populations, so there may be some Minnesota-specific effect, but I think we can learn a lot from states who have had these types of plans in place and have had some experience with them and have not seen large, if any, premium impacts to consumers through offering the flexibility that comes from these types of plan designs in addition to their existing products.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the response from the department. The only other thing I would point to is, I know we're not talking about this bill today, but the bill on the frozen formulary. We had a fiscal note on, the CGIP impact, that it's more than $25 million per year. But then in the department's analysis on what impact that would have on premiums, again, the response was unlikely that this, bill will produce a substantive increase to premiums, kind of despite that analysis that we saw on the CGIP side. And so my, encouragement to the department would be to just in the next iteration provide more details on the cost and information. And even if we just do have some ranges, I think it would be helpful for members of this committee to see what other data points are out there so that we can try to take that into consideration. Because I think all of us, want to provide, more benefits to more people and have more access to more treatments that are effective. But the question is, always what's the cost and what does that ultimately end up showing up in premium? So just encourage the department to continue working on refining, how they present that analysis in these reports. But thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I had.
Mr. Brickway, you unmuted. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rasmussen, really appreciate that feedback. And I think you highlighted something in one of the other reports that we're not going to get into today, but I do think it's worth noting that I do want to differentiate between potential costs to the health plans that the state would be responsible for defraying if a proposal was found to be a new benefit mandate, and cost impacts to CGIP in CGIP's capacity as the state's health employee plan. And so those two things, while ultimately the state is responsible for those costs, there are very different reasons for why those costs might exist. I certainly wouldn't want to speak on CGIP's behalf. So the law in 62J requires us to consult with MMB and include that information, but I would see that as something sort of separate and distinct, and we'd be happy to connect you with our colleagues at CGIP from the rest of our report. But Representative Rasmussen, I appreciate that we can think about how we integrate those pieces differently. I see colleagues of ours from the Department of Human Services in the Zoom room as well, too. I know that to the extent that there are proposals of this nature that might authors may have an interest in having applied to public programs as well, too, we would also want to integrate the analysis from our colleagues at DHS about what those cost implications might look like. So I just wanted to clarify that there are many considerations about what cost might be when it comes to the state in different categories. And so we'll think about how to integrate those and make them clear in the future. Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen, anything you wanted to add there?
I'm good, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I see no other members seeking recognition on this bill. So Representative Bierman, I don't know if you have any closing comments.
No, just to appreciate your time to committee. Thank you very much. We'll move this bill forward and look for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Because this is an informational hearing, we won't need to do anything further on it, but thank you for joining us today and good luck in the Health Committee. The next bill that we're going to take a look at is House File 2915, offered by Representative Poston. Representative Poston, if you'd like to describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members for this informational hearing on House File 2915 today. Basically, our bill requires covering treatments related to ectodermal dysplasia. And you hear that big word and you probably are wondering what it is, but I've got a couple of testifiers here today that have lived with this or have a child living with this that I would like to let have the majority of the time today. We have gotten this through committees for 6 years, but we've never got it over that final finish line. And we never were able to do that because we didn't have this type of report that we got from the Commerce Department. And we got a favorable report we're very happy to get. And I do have to say that the Commerce Department and MMB have been very, very helpful with us making some changes to the bill over time and giving us all of this information. And I will make a couple of comments about the evaluation in my closing comments, but Chair, I'd like to spend most of the time with my testifiers. I have two. The first one I have is Carl Nelson, and Carl Nelson has lived his whole life with ectodermal dysplasia and has a child with this condition. And then the second testifier is Molly Gonesser, and she has a child with this condition. And they have a really good PowerPoint that they'd like to go through with the committee and explain exactly what this is and what this coverage would look like. And then again, in my closing statements, I'll make some comments about the evaluation.
That sounds good to me, Representative Poston, and thank you for bringing those testifiers today, and we'd love to hear from them. So we'll start with Mr. Nelson. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to see if I can screen share, and hopefully this will work. So let me know if this does work.
It's working.
Okay. And let me try to move this up so I can. Okay, is that working? Good?
We are, yep, we are seeing the presentation. Okay.
All right. So I want to just, first of all, I wanted to thank you all, committee members, and Representative Poston for letting me tell you my story and let my voice be heard. My name is Carl Nelson, and I have ectodermal dysplasia, as Representative Poston commented on. I'm going to attempt to summarize my life in about 3 to 4 minutes because of time, but hopefully I will also educate you on something that's close to my heart and something that I think is very, very wrong that I'd like to figure out how to change. And I hope after I'm done that you guys will walk away from this and say, why isn't this already covered? I'm hoping you'll work with myself and Representative Poston to move this forward in both the House and the Senate. And I'd like to start closing this gap between things that we feel are medically necessary reconstructions and what other groups deem cosmetic. Issues like these have been going on for decades, and we need to move forward together to stop repeating over and over again this problem. I've been dealing with this my whole life, and my inspiration, Sammy, is my daughter. She will deal with the same things unless we can help stop this cycle. And as a rare disease community, it's hard for our voice to be heard. And so we really do appreciate you giving us the time to discuss this. We're all of us, you, me, everybody on this phone call, we're all striving to make the world better for our kids. So let's do this together. So this is Sammy, and she's an awesome little girl. And I'd like to just go through what our ectodermal dysplasia is so you guys know. And I'm sorry my slide is moving on me, but these are changes of the ectoderm. And these include things like abnormal or missing teeth. Many of our kids don't sweat, very severe itching, abnormal hair, and I'll talk about myself in a minute, abnormal nails, missing or abnormal breast tissue. We have some varying types that have hand deformities, facial deformities, some that progress to blindness. There's cleft lip, cleft palate that can be involved in several subtypes of our these ectodermal dysplasias. The current understanding of the incidence is 3 in 10,000, which would put it about 20 people in Minnesota per year would be diagnosed with this. Some of those would be carriers, I would assume, but there are about 20 maybe per year that are delivered. The most common subtype is hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, which I mentioned is they don't sweat, they really have a hard time regulating their temperature, but missing teeth, hair, nails are very common in that subject. I'm going to go to the next slide. These are a few pictures here I'd like to illustrate, sorry, that our oral manifestations can be very significant and life-changing. I mean, they are drastic where you have a couple teeth, maybe you have some teeth, but they're conical. Every person is unfortunately, you know, different here, and you can imagine that chewing might be a challenge. But guess what? So is speech. So is digestion. It's all related. It's not just cosmetic. Sparse hair, abnormal nails, eczema, and dental, which is a significant. All right, well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, and I chose just a great photo of me. As a child. So I was diagnosed at 5. I had dentures at 5, both the dentist and ENT at 5 years old. After bouncing around health systems at Mayo and U of M, we finally got a diagnosis. Obviously, this is a big team to figure out these things, family medicine, ENT, dental, dermatology, genetics, ophthalmology, insurance denials throughout my life. And I'm 49. So this is not a new problem. That's what I'm trying to tell you. This is not a new problem. My dad was in the House of Representatives. My grandpa was in politics. It's a hard thing to change, but we have to figure out a way to change it. Insurance denials for dentures throughout my whole life, really. But as you can tell, I had a strong passion sense. Throughout high school, and you know, when you're growing up, you want to be normal. You want to be just like everybody else. So I worked really hard for that. And it was not easy, but I lost my hair in the 5th, 6th grade and started wearing a wig in 7th grade. And that was hard. My parents were very, worked hard to try to help with coverage and everything, but we had a difficult time getting coverage for prosthetic wigs, and as well as dentures, as I mentioned. So I wore my wig trying to be normal until I felt I was normal when I got married. In my 20s, I had my oral reconstruction done. My baby teeth had basically rotted away, leaving me with no option but to move to a permanent, more stable appliance or fixture. So I had to have these implants placed in my mouth, 5 on the top, 5 on the bottom. This is a fix for a congenital defect. This is not cosmetic. This is, and by the way, I don't wish this on anybody. I'm not going out here for fun. So this is screws and sedation and bone grafting to get these anchors in put in place. And I got an estimate of a couple of years ago when Representative Post and I were working on this the first time. And just to make the picture like this with the screws in my bones, it was about $30,000 to $50,000 for the implants to be placed, and $40,000 just for the dentures to be built, so that I could be normal and I can talk. I work in healthcare. My patients would not really probably appreciate me coming in without any teeth or anything. So these are all out-of-pocket expenses. All right, I'd like to talk a little bit about this bill itself. This HF 1915 has a few components to it, and I'm hoping that everyone agrees that these are good changes. So we would like to figure out ensuring that there's coverage for reconstructive surgeries for this rare population, including dentures, implants, bone grafting, orthodontics to try to straighten things out if needed, and maintenance, also including wigs. So there are some statutes I'm going to talk about in a second, but wigs for alopecia related ectodermal dysplasia and breast nipple reconstruction. My daughter doesn't have any breasts. I don't care. I don't have any breasts. It's not a big deal, but for her, it's going to be a huge deal, and that's not cosmetic. She needs to be able to have an avenue to be able to do that. Precedents in place in Minnesota. We have stipulations for things like this. Cleft lip, cleft palate already has a statute for their oral protections. We have wigs already set up for alopecia areata, but not for alopecia due to ectodermal dysplasia or alopecia due to other things. Breast reconstruction is already there, secondary to mastectomy for breast cancer. So we have things that are already in place that are precedent for the same type of bill. Now, the other aspect I want to say is we had a bill a couple of years ago, the PANS bill or PANDAS bill, that passed. It was a mandate, and that ended up having little or no effect after Congress did a review. And so we hope that we, because of our small population, that we would be able to follow that same pattern. But I personally feel like even if there is a small cost, that it's worth it for all these people. I'd like to move, I want to say, let's move forward together. I would like all of you please to be on my team. I'd like to introduce Molly, who actually has three daughters with ectodermal dysplasia, but Hannah has actually affected the most significantly. Molly, and I'll try to stop my screen sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for sharing your story and sharing that information with us. We really appreciate your time coming today and sharing that story with us. Ms. Ganasor, I apologize. Ms. Ganasor.
Is there, Molly? You might be muted.
How about that?
There you go. We can hear you.
All right. We gotcha. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and for the committee for listening to us. This is so passionate. We are so passionate. And like Carl said and Representative Poston said, I have three daughters. And it's kind of a fascinating situation where my ex-husband has ectodermal dysplasia and the gene is passed down, and how it turned out that my oldest daughter is a carrier of ectodermal dysplasia. She is not affected by it, but she could pass it on to kids depending on the gene that she passes. Then I have twin daughters, and that's what's the fascinating part, Hannah and Aaron. Aaron is affected a little bit with her teeth, so she needs some dental work. Hannah's affected the most. And we knew pretty quick when she was a baby that she does not have any sweat glands, so she does not sweat. So regulating body temperature is a huge deal. But the thing that we've been dealing with the most and the most frustrating for us is her teeth. She was born with six teeth on top and only two in the bottom, which are the molars in the very back. So like Carl, the journey through dentures is unbelievable. And like he said, he's 49 and look how long he's been battling this. And my daughters are now 25. And I was stunned when they were younger, when we started going through the system of trying to get my daughter teeth. And I even have them still. I save them so people can see. her very first, she had a little flipper. This is like a little flipper thing when she had a couple front teeth, and they put in this little flipper with teeth on the sides, and she clipped that in so she could be normal in grade school. And then she had, I just dropped her bottom ones. And then in grade school, we went to the U of M, and they determined she needed full dentures to cover her existing teeth. And so here's her top dentures. This is a first grader. Bottom dentures, and they would clip around her molars here. And I don't know how many of you have kids that you'd have to tell. It still gets me to this day. She's 25 years old, and I have to tell my child to go put her teeth in, and she'd get Polident and rub her little gums and put Polident in and put her teeth in. And then during grade school, when her teeth would turn loose, we had a little deal with the nurse that she had her little area. She could go into the nurse's office and clean out her teeth and put them back in again because they'd get loose. And I try to make her feel as normal as she could while I'm battling insurance. And I'm battling insurance, and they're telling me that it's denied because it's cosmetic. And she has no teeth in the bottom, none. She was born with none. And they're telling me it's cosmetic. And that's unbelievable to me. And so we had to pay out of pocket, and she'd outgrow these dentures as her jaw would change, which, by the way, the jaw doesn't grow normal when you don't have teeth. So that doesn't develop normally. So when she's a teenager, she had to have the bone grafting like Carl had to have. And that's just awful. So bone grafting, they take bone from other parts of your body and build up the bone area, and that's not covered. So we had to pay for that. And then we were fighting insurance to try to get implants covered. And they're telling me still that's cosmetic. And I got letters from pediatricians that it's to support me that that's not cosmetic because it's necessary for facial growth, for normal bone growth, for nutrition. We sent letters and bombarded them, and we got denied every time saying it's cosmetic. Yet, if someone gets in a car accident and knocks their teeth out, health insurance covers new teeth. Meth addicts that at treatment centers that get teeth that come out because of meth use, do you know our state covers new teeth for them? And then my daughter gets told that her teeth are cosmetic and they don't get covered. So we've been going through this battle. We've been testifying, as Carl said, for years, and hoping it was going to be pushed through. A couple years ago, we were at an oral surgeon who did a ceramic $3,500 overlay on her top to buy some time. And that's come out twice, and we've had to have it re-cemented in. She has nothing on the bottom because it doesn't stay, and she's 25 years old. She's a nurse at a hospital in the Twin Cities here. She gets asked many times if she has cancer. She gets asked all the time if she has cancer. She has sparse hair. What these people put up with is unbelievable. And my twins ask me all the time, Mom, when can we get our teeth? When can we get our teeth? And every time this is knocked down, every time this doesn't pass, I have to go to them and say, I'm so sorry. The estimate for my kids' teeth is about $175,000 to $200,000. So my husband and I just last fall sold our house. And we put money away to pay for it because they just can't wait anymore. The bone grafting is starting to deteriorate that they had done, and that has to be, the teeth has to be put in, or that work is ruined. And so we decided to sell our house to pay for their teeth because we just can't wait anymore. And that makes me so sad. And I don't want for kids like Sammy, Carl and Nancy's daughter, and for another family that we work with, for their little girl, Ava, I don't want them to go through what we've gone through. And so I'm very emotional and passionate about this for our kids. And my kids could easily pass on ectodermal to their kids. And my daughters say, Mom, my kids are afraid to have children. They're 27 and 25. And they said they don't want their kids to go through what they've gone through, and they see financially what it's done to us in having to sell our house to pay for teeth. So when Carl asked me to come and testify, I'm more than willing, and Representative Poston, I just appreciate the work he's done, and I appreciate the time that you guys have given us to listen to us. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing that story. I know it was very difficult to share it, and it really shows your passion and commitment to it. And you know, a number of us on the committee are parents. Myself, I have two school age kids, so I can only imagine when you were describing the experience of, you know, helping your kids get dentures on in the morning. I can only imagine that. So thank you for coming and for sharing
the story.
I very much appreciate it. Representative Poston, you said you wanted to comment on the report. I don't know. Do you want to hear from Mr. Benchu first, or would you like to comment now?
They can go ahead, Chair. That would be fine.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Mr. Benchu.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I'll give a brief overview of our findings on this one. So in our analysis of whether this would constitute a benefit mandate under the ACA requiring QHP to frail, we did find that because some of the services identified in the bill are not covered by our state benchmark plan, and because most of the medical dental services that identified would not meet coverage, would not meet criteria for coverage in the benchmark and also fall outside the scope of medical plan coverage in general, we determined that it would be a benefit mandate for that reason. So there would be a fiscal cost to the state most likely. However, I just add briefly that just because Commerce does consider a particular bill to be a benefit mandate, it doesn't automatically mean that the state would incur costs. It of course depends on QHP enrollment and condition prevalence in those affected plans. But we did note a likely cost to the state through that, and CGIP did note a cost impact to their plan as well.
Thank you, Mr. Benchu. Representative Poston?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. You know, some of the notes that I took down as I went through the evaluation, MMB estimated a monthly increase of 5 cents on premiums. Both the Department of Commerce and health plans believe that a substantial increase in premiums is unlikely. And that's a statement kind of like Representative Rasmussen talked about earlier. What does that mean? But they did quantify this a little bit with 5 cents, they thought, per premium per month, which seems like a very small amount to pay to help these children. Again, like you, Chair, I can't imagine a five-year-old putting in dentures in the morning. I can't imagine a five-year-old putting a wig on. I can't imagine what they must go through at school. And, you know, to talk about those teeth for just a minute, you know, teeth, I just became a grandpa. So I have a one-year-old grandson, and he goes through onesies. You know, he wears them like once or twice, and then he's got to go on to the next size. And that's what happens with these teeth. They go through denture after denture after denture after denture until they're old enough, mature enough to have implants and bone grafting. And to the tune of $250,000, you know, from the time they're born up to that point in their life. So, you know, I really think that this is something that we should be able to get behind because of that low cost. And I have to tell you, I'm a volunteer at a Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. And I've had this conversation with Molly about how many meth students, you know, we've had over the years at the Brainerd campus that have lost all their teeth and gotten them replaced. And it just doesn't seem right that these little kids can't get teeth, can't get coverage. They're told it's cosmetic, but a meth addict can get taken care of. An accident, you know, like you hit your face against the dashboard and knock your teeth out, you get it taken care of. So it's really not cosmetic. They're necessary. It's needed. I think that this report from Commerce came back very positive. Again, they were very helpful. MMB was very helpful. And I'm really hoping that after 6 years, that with this new process and everything, we're going to be able to get this over the finish line. And these kids are going to be able to get the care that they deserve and should have gotten now for many years. So I appreciate it, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Are there any members who want to discuss this or ask questions? We are starting to run a little light on time, but certainly if members have questions or comments they want to make, we have time for that. Seeing none, we'll thank Representative Poston for bringing this bill today, and thank the testifiers for sharing their stories once again. And we'll move on to the last of the mandate bills that we're going to look at today, which is House File 56, Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, we have about 15 minutes here for your bill, just as a heads up, and we'll move to you first, Representative Elkins.
We should be good. We only have one testifier, and I think this discussion should be fairly short. So the gist of the report on this, and I should say that I was the lead author on House File 55, which is the bill that established this process. This bill is House File 56, and I introduced them together on purpose because based on the research that I'd done on this particular topic, where there were at least three other states that have already implemented this kind of a requirement, and in all cases, the actual experience of those states was favorable in terms of the cost effectiveness of the requirement. And I thought that this review would pretty much come out the way it did, except for one kind of surprise was that what basically the report says is that this really isn't a new mandate because health plans in Minnesota, at least the ones that are that we're able to regulate, are already generally offering this benefit. And so we have one testifier this afternoon, Kathy Wright, who is both a lymphedema patient and an expert in employee benefit law, who is familiar with the general legal framework around this issue. And I think that Kathy is going to tell you that it is not the experience of the typical lymphedema sufferer in Minnesota that they're the standards of care for this treatment, which were described to us in great detail last year by Dr. Nancy Hutchison, that this are not being consistently applied in that way. So one of the key findings to me in the analysis where it stated the specific services and items identified by this bill for lymphedema treatment are not new and are covered under the state's benchmark plan. Nonetheless, by specifically adding these services into statute, consumers and patients could be more reasonably assured that they will receive coverage for service. And I think that's the objective here from my perspective and from the perspective of people who suffer from this condition, is that they should be able to expect a reasonably consistent standard of care coverage of the of this condition. So I would like at this point to turn it over to Kathy if she's available.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kathy Wright. My
pronouns. Yes, Ms. Wright, welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you. I jumped right in. I guess when I hear time is short, I want to move. Yeah. My name is Kathy Wright. I am a lymphedema sufferer. I had breast cancer 5 years ago, and at that time had a double mastectomy and had lymph nodes removed, sentinel lymph nodes on both sides, and then on one side went on and had more lymph nodes removed because there was some cancerous activity, and that negatively impacted my lymphatic system and gave me lymphedema. So what I have here, and I've got a suit on so you can't see, but I wear a sleeve and a glove. And these are my compression systems in order to keep my lymphatic system under control, because what ends up happening if I don't do that and if I don't do my manual massage, I call it the fat wiener arm, but basically my arm will get big, my hand will look like a surgical glove blown up into a balloon. So this is something I need to deal with every day. I am fortunate in that I have employer coverage through my husband. It is a self-funded governmental plan, so it falls within the requirements of the state statutes, but it is not an ERISA plan, and self-funded ERISA plans, of course, are not required to have them. The reason I think this is important is I've always had some coverage, but it changes every year. In any given year, I can be told I'm eligible for four sleeve and glove combinations. Up to 1 year, I think I could get 24. So my sleeve and glove together, $950. That's not ultimately what ends up being paid because you're all familiar with the insurance system and the discounts. But for an individual who needs, say, they work for every 6 months, you need to have them updated. And realistically, I think having 5, 6, 7 is a realistic amount because, let's face it, we don't want to be doing laundry every other day. And you can't wear these more than once because they need to be laundered in order to keep the compression grade consistent. So, you know, my thought would be at a minimum, you would want to be requiring 14 sets a year. I am just one person. I understand that, you know, there's leg lymphedema, that the lymphatic system is throughout the body, and compression garments are the standard of care for all areas of lymphedema. So other individuals might need something more. I know there's a concern that by changing Statute 62 and requiring it, it's not reaching all of the different kinds of coverage that are available. And of course, some of them will have to go to the federal level. Obviously, changing Statute 62 is not going to change Medicare, but there's a different process going on to deal with that. I can say that we are lucky in the state of Minnesota in that when there is a change to the insurance statute, even the private employer ERISA plans tend to adopt those requirements because they want to be competitive in the market with what they are offering. So the fact that this is not something that's changing a federal standard right now still will be helpful to anybody who needs this kind of coverage under the insurance industry. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else. The one thing I want to mention, I jokingly call it my fat wiener arm. It is not necessarily just swelling as if I ate too much salt and my ankles were swollen the next day, but boy, were those nachos great. That's not what this is. This is a failure of the lymphatic system. The lymphatic system is probably the second largest organ in your body. I'm not a medical person, but I look at the skin as our largest organ. Our next one is going to be our lymphatic system. And that basically helps all of our systems work. So when there is either a primary, if you're born with a default problem in your lymphatic system, or if you have secondary lymphedema because of a surgery or an accident, this impacts that whole system. Without staying up to date on compression and keeping it under control, you can end up with serious infections. In fact, I've run into one woman through my lymphatic groups that at all times needs to know where the nearest emergency room is, because when an infection starts with her, it moves so fast that she needs to be at all times be within 20 to 30 minutes of an emergency room. I'm fortunate in that I haven't had to deal with that, but I am told that there are very many of my fellow sufferers who do have to deal with that. So again, to be able to have a consistent source for these garments to be doing the majority of the work that we can do to keep this under control and not trigger other expenses in the health system, I think is very important. And then again, finally, the fact that if this ends up being part of the Minnesota statute, which I hope it does, it will end up, you know, directly impacting the insurance industry and some public employers. And because we are Minnesota and because we have some of the greatest health care and health systems in the country, we will have a number of employers who will voluntarily adopt this. And this will be one step forward in trying to help people with my condition keep it under control, maintain it and not have to deal with some of the very serious consequences that we can end up with when that doesn't happen.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Benchouf.
Mr. Chair, members, I can be super brief on this one. So Commerce's findings were that this would not be a benefit mandate under the ACA because the services identified in the bill are already covered by the benchmark plan. So no anticipated fiscal impact to the state overall. And in terms of premium impact, we would anticipate just a minimal impact to insurance premiums.
Thank you, Mr. Benchouf. Any questions or discussion to the bill or the department's report? Hearing none, Representative Elkins, I'll give you the final word on your bill.
No, thank you. I think I think the way this process is working out, with the one exception of improving the outreach a little bit, is we're seeing today is working as intended. And you know, I think we're seeing in the case of all three of these bills that they're worthwhile.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Representative Elkins. That concludes where we are in House File. Give Bentley Graves of the Chamber of Commerce a chance to speak about these bills. Usually when we do mandate bills, we ask the chamber and the health plans if they want to speak more generally rather than. File 56. Already out of this committee and in the health committee, but we realize that House File 2915, Representative Poston's bill, is still in the possession of the Commerce Committee. I think what we're going to do, I was just communicating with Representative O'Driscoll, the Republican lead, I think we're going to schedule that bill for committee action next week. I don't expect to take further testimony on since we had it today. Certainly, if there are other public members who want to speak to it, we will give that option, and we'll have.
The chairman and Representative Elkins, the many members of the committee that were engaged in the last couple of years in putting together the specifics of this manual review process. I want to thank the department for their work over the last many months to produce these reports. You all know that these issues are of great interest to us. A vast majority of our members as employer members. Purchase coverage for their employees in the fully insured market. And as you've heard through these reports, all of these proposals would impact them, as well as the others that were part of the package of reviews that weren't presented today. And the goal in all that was to ensure that all of us, stakeholders, policymakers, legislators, regulators, got a better sense of the cost benefit trade-offs associated with each of these proposals. And I think, the reports produced this year take a very important step forward in that process. Yeah, I appreciate the testimony from all of those folks that offered their thoughts up today. And you can hear firsthand that all these come with some benefits for a number of folks and would very much improve their lives. And as you've heard too, between these three reports and if you read the other three, they all do come with some costs, some greater than others. But that's a trade-off that is inherent in all of these. And we're hopeful that as these proposals move forward, as other ideas come forward in future years, that this mandate review process will be there to help all of us again kind of weigh out the trade-offs associated with that. Because again, our members have costs as a front and center concern. The cost of healthcare is something that is weighs heavily on their ability to attract and retain talent and to continue to offer coverage to their employees. And so Again, we're hopeful that this is a tool going forward that all of us can utilize to much better understand the push and pull of these proposals going forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the members of the committee. Thank you for the testifiers. Thank you to the department for all the work that's gone into this. And we look forward to being a participant in these conversations going forward and helping to refine this process in the years ahead. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. And thank you to the department and all the testifiers and bill authors for discussion of the health mandate review. With the limited time we have remaining, the last 20 minutes, we're going to talk about another bill that passed last year. This is the Student Borrower Bill of Rights, which passed into law as part of the Commerce, Climate, and Energy Omnibus. We're going to hear from the department about their implementation about that law, and then we'll look at a proposal to take the next step in helping our students deal with the crushing student loan crisis. So first, we have a presenter from the Department of Commerce, Mr. Hasty.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. I believe John Kaley is also going to help with our slide presentation. One second here.
Folks seeing it?
Can everyone see the presentation?
Looks good.
Okay. So John, I'm going to skip ahead to the next slide here. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to give an update on the implementation of this bill that was passed last year. The first slide here, I won't go through all of it, but basically just a reminder of some of the key parts of the law that was passed last year. Definitions, the requirement to license student loan servicers, and then a number of exemptions, and really the key issues around the Bill of Rights, the dues and prohibitions that were in the bill, which I'll talk about in a second here. But really, the department's role was then to start giving up examination authority and enforcement authority. And also, before I go to the next slide, my name is Mark Hasty, H-A-S-T-I-E. I want to make sure I give my name for the record too before we move on there. So John, if you can go to the next slide, I'll go there. That'd be great. So really, there are five areas. I'll cover the first four. John will talk about the last one, communications. Licensing, examinations, regulatory outreach, enforcement, and then as it will cover communications. So next slide would be great, John. So as you know, the law was passed last year, late in the session, with an effective date of August 1st. We immediately set up a new licensing process through the NMLS. That's the system we use for all of our non-depository financial institutions. And basically, since the bill went into effect, we've had over 30 companies who have gotten licensed with us, which was roughly what we expected. We expected 30 to 35 entities that would get licensed. And all those companies went through a renewal process at the end of the calendar year, and they're all renewed for 2022. So most of them were in good shape and where we expected to be on the licensing. And so the process had a quick turnaround. We did create a separate application process for our federal student loan servicers, which are those five or six companies that do the federal student loans. And that has worked well too, a very streamlined process. Next slide, John. So examinations is really the next step here. And as the department has hired an examiner exclusively for to start this process, who started 2 months ago. And as you can see here from the information, you know, we have already started drafting an examination procedures manual, which is in the early stages and should be done within the next month or so, really, we anticipate. And so it's been a fairly quick turnaround. We've been able to gather a lot of sample documents from other states and the CFPB, which was helpful. And really right now, we've actually joined a joint exam with the CFPB and other states already on one of our largest federal student loan servicers, which has been great. We've been able to jump in immediately. And looking forward, second quarter 2022, we do anticipate starting our own single state exams and joining on more multiple state exams. There's about, we're one of 13 or 14 states that has this this process. And that gets right to our regulatory outreach, which is the next slide. And so we have participated in multiple calls with federal regulators, including the Department of Education, state AGs, other regulators, which are monthly now. We've joined an ad hoc working group with all the other states, and there's a new task force, actually. One of our regulatory associations is joined with another one to create a new task force on student loan servicing and lending, which we will be participating in. And so we're looking forward to enhancing those processes this year from that viewpoint. Next slide, John. So the enforcement division in our team, we've only had really a handful of complaints, contacts with us, really, and they're really about, you know, more about navigating the Public Loan Student Forgiveness Program. As members may or may not know, there's still, on federal loans, there's no payment, there's no forbearance until May at this point. And so we haven't had too many complaints right now. We have had some calls. The Attorney General's office settled with Navient Solutions. It was a multi-state AG settlement. It was announced last month, and so there's been calls coming in there. And so we anticipate going forward that, as I said, as people start to make more payments in the future, we'll probably start getting more calls from consumers. So I will turn it over to John to talk about communications. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you, Chair, members. My name is John Kelly. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'll just give a very brief update on the efforts around communications around the bill. So this first slide here describes we have a commerce webpage, fact sheet, videos, and digital ads. And this is the webpage link there. We did an event with Chair Stevenson and Commissioner Arnold folks at St. Cloud Community and Technical College. This was covered by local media. We also featured the Minnesota Student Association and Commissioner of Higher Education Olson. We have ongoing posts around this on the Minnesota Department of Commerce Twitter account. We have a paid media RFP. We selected marketer Russell Herder, a woman-owned B Corp. We have a digital campaign that ran from December 2021 to January of 2022. The digital ads were seen more than 1.8 million times, more than 17,000 unique views, and there was 13,857 unique visitors to the department. We also recorded videos with both Lieutenant Governor Flanagan and with Chair Stevenson to try to get the word out around this. Mark touched on this. We'll remind the members of the committee and public that right now student loans repayments does not restart until May 1st. If you can help get the word out as we share posts relating to this important bill and in your newsletters to your constituents, especially as we get closer to May, sharing info about the Student Loan Borrower Bill of Rights. And I'll stop there. And we're ready between financial institutions and government affairs if there are questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hasty, Mr. Kelly. Are there any questions before we move to the bill? Seeing none, I will hand the virtual gavel over to Vice Chair Katiza Watoon, as the bill we're going to consider is mine.
Next up, we have House File 3063 from Chair Stevenson. Representative Stevenson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. I would move House File 3063 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I understand that you have an A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like.
And I would move the A1 amendment.
All right, very good. Chair Stevenson moves the A1 amendment. Any member questions about the A1? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor?
Please aye.
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 All those opposed? All right, very good. So Chair Stevenson, as House File 3063 as amended is before the committee, feel free to begin.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Watoon, and I will be very brief here as the time is short. And this bill, is the next step forward in our discussion about the student loan crisis in Minnesota. We adopted the very important Student Borrower Bill of Rights last year that included a number of protections for students. Now we want to make sure that we are educating our students as to their rights and opportunities under this bill, but also make sure that they don't get into trouble in the first place. And so the bill requires the Department of Commerce to create an educational course and take it on the road to educational institutions to help students stay out of trouble in the first place. Let them know about student loans and the various payment opportunities available in hopes that people don't dig themselves into a hole that they need to get out of down the way. The bill also would give more enforcement firepower to the Department of Commerce so that they can make sure to take care of people when their rights are violated. And so I think it's an important step forward in the framework that we established last year. We did get a fiscal note back, which is in the on the committee page. Commerce anticipates needing another 1.5 FTE to execute this portion of the bill. This bill doesn't include an appropriation for Commerce at this time. That'll be something that the committee will take a look at when and if we get to the supplemental budget portion. With that, I believe I do have a testifier.
All right. Yes, we have Ryan Fierick with Education Minnesota. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Ryan Fierick, thank you, Madam Chair, current Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fierick, and I'm a teacher at Crossroads School in the St. Francis School District. I'm currently on leave as Vice President of Education Minnesota. I'm here to express our support for House File 3063 and to talk about why this legislation is critically necessary, not just for educators that I represent, but also for the students and families across the state. We know Minnesota ranks fifth in the nation with student debt. More than 900,000 Minnesotans have student debt, and it averages about $37,000 for each borrower. Educators are particularly aware of the problems around student debt because we take on more than an average amount of debt to go into our field. As we grapple with the challenges in paying back our own loans, we frequently support students who are all taking on increasing amounts of debt and struggling with how to make smart choices as they do so. We hear from students that is one of their concerns is the ability to manage and pay off education debt that makes them choose not to go into education. Even more worrying is that we hear of our colleagues who are already in our schools in support staff roles. They are choosing not to become teachers due to the concerns of navigating the student loan issues that they hear about. These are folks that have expertises in schools that would make them excellent educators. Especially right now, we cannot afford to lose future educators because of the issues that can be resolved through better information and advocacy. The Student Loan Advocate Bill solves really critical problems that we hear from our educators, students, and family. We need better information about loans and repayment options. We don't get that from loan servicers or from college financial aid offices. I can speak from experience. I paid my loans for 7 years before I learned that I was paying an incorrect repayment plan and therefore disqualifying me from earning anything towards student loan forgiveness. A student loan advocate could help serve as a clearinghouse for trusted information for borrowers like me. And an advocate could have helped me work with my loan servicer to address the situation and rectify it sooner. We need education and support for borrowers before they become borrowers. Students will benefit from the provisions in this bill that requires the student loan advocate to provide education to borrowers upfront so they can make good choices when making necessary student loans and be better prepared for paying them back. Taking out student loans is an unavoidable reality for individuals and families who are paying for college. This bill ensures that Minnesotans will have someone on our side to provide support to borrowers and our families, which will contribute to a positive financial future for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fierick. We don't have any additional authors, testifiers, nor any testifiers from the public signed up to testify today. So we'll move to member discussion. Okay, Representative Tice.
Needs help operating her Zoom. I just thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a couple questions which have been kind of coming to front because of different conversations I'm having with parents, with students that have been having difficulties going to college because of the way things have been in the last couple of years. So are there any is there any data that we can get from how many students are we looking at now that are going to college that and how many
is possible but haven't been going, or else they've quit because it's just been really difficult for them to go. And if they have taken out a loan and decided to quit because in one case, their son was having some real mental health issues because of this, how does that play into it? Are we seeing students going to school and then deciding that it's just not for them at this time? Do we have advocates that can help before they quit? Or is that a whole different something? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Tice. You know, obviously the last couple of years have been pretty traumatic for everyone, really, and a lot of it has led to a lot of disruption for people. And I think that's why it's very commendable that the Trump administration and the Biden administration have both put a pause on student loan repayment during these times to allow for some of that, what you're talking about, to work out. Because when someone is in school getting their education, their student loan payments are deferred. Of course, if someone has to leave because they are having a mental health issue that's, you know, in part because of the pandemic, they would have to start repaying their loans. But thanks to the federal administration, right now that isn't the case, and that will continue till May at this point, and that's a good thing. I think that in terms of the financial situation that people face with their loans, that's what this bill is about having someone that they can turn to help them navigate the situation, whether they're leaving school because of their a mental health issue or any reason, to understand the various repayment opportunities, forbearances, and other things that are available to people in that situation. And also to help people on the front end to understand, before you take on this debt, here's how it's going to play out in the long run, because really we don't want people taking on debt with under you know, false pretenses about what's going to happen after the fact. I don't have specific numbers about how many people you know, are in college right now or out. I did just get a text message telling me there's 900,000 Minnesotans with student debt. And I often point out that student debt across the country is now the second largest form of debt behind only mortgage debt. So there's more student loan debt in our country than credit card debt right now, which is a kind of astounding fact for me. So I think this bill will help with some of the things you're talking about. It isn't the catch-all for it. You know, somewhat, it isn't really to help people with mental health concerns, but it would help them with the student loan consequences brought on from having to leave school.
Representative Tice, any follow-up? All right, members, any further questions on House File 3060 as amended? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Stevenson, I'll give you the last word on your bill.
This is a good bill. I hope we all get a chance to vote for it in an omnibus later.
Very good. Representative Stevenson renews his motion to lay 3060 over for possible inclusion in the Commerce Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over, and the meeting is adjourned.